Why haven't rising rent prices spurred investments in housing like the last time the economy was booming?
How do one-size-fits-all laws at the state level negatively impact cost-of-living issues for urban versus rural areas?
It seems like only luxury condos are being built, and it seems like they're also being left unoccupied. Is this true? And if it is, will market forces eventually drive their prices down?
When it comes to housing in California and why it costs so much, you have questions. During the next hour, we'll answer them. Ben Metcalf from the California Department of Housing and Community Development and Bernadette Austin with the UC Davis Center for Regional Change join us in studio. We'll also hear from Senator Scott Wiener and California Dream reporters Matt Levin, Amita Sharma, and Ben Bradford. And columnist Gustavo Arellano weighs in on the real cost of illegal immigration. From the California Dream Collaboration, this is One State Unaffordable. I'm Randall White from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. From the California Dream Collaboration, this is One State Unaffordable. I'm Randall White from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Public radio stations from around the state, including KQED, KPCC, KPBS, and Capital Public Radio, along with CalMatters, have teamed up to explore the idea of the California Dream. What's that dream look like today? In this one-hour special, we'll explore the issues behind rising housing costs in California and get answers to some of your most pressing questions. In our studio are three people who know a lot about housing in California. Ben Metcalf is the director of the California Department of Housing and Community Development. Bernadette Austin is the associate director for the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. And Matt Levin is CalMatters data reporter, and he focuses most of his attention on housing issues. Ben, Bernadette, Matt, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Let's start with one question that we got over and over. Why is it so, and pardon the expression, damn expensive, but that's how it was written in these questions, to buy or rent a place in California? And Matt, why don't we start with you on that?
Sure. So I think most experts, including those in this room, would probably agree that fundamentally California has not built enough housing to keep up with demand for housing in this state. So actually, Ben's department estimated that we need about 180,000 units of new housing every year just to keep pace with demand. So just to keep prices from getting worse than they currently are. And we basically average less than half of that. In the last couple of years, permits for new building have gone up. So that's a positive sign. But fundamentally, the issue is we haven't built enough to keep up with the people who currently live here and want to live here.
So, Ben, at the root of it, it's a supply and demand issue?
It is, yeah. And it's a funny one because, you know, if you look, for example, what we're building this past year versus what we were building a little over a decade ago before we went into the crisis, we haven't made back up to where we were even in the mid-aughts. And in fact, as Matt is alluding to, we're well below where we were at our peak, which would have been in the 60s and 70s and 80s, where we were building really at the appropriate levels. So I think there's a lot of reasons for this. One clearly is coming out of the financial crisis. We have lost a lot of the labor force. So a lot of folks who were construction workers moved on into other professions. We've also seen increased costs. So it costs more to build a home, like both in terms of the raw materials, but also additional compliance items that we now expect of builders. So we're looking for higher seismic standards. We're looking for greater energy efficiency standards, and those do have a cost. And then lastly, I'd just say, I don't think, you know, at the end of the day in communities, we also find just a very practical challenge of many people are very concerned about change and don't want to see large developments happening and use local elected officials to tip the balance away from that kind of density that we need.
Bernadette, you were shaking your head through a lot of that. And he was saying that people are afraid of change, but that's your whole center, regional change. So how do we do that without upsetting the apple cart?
No, it's really challenging. I mean, the other piece that I think of, too, is around home ownership, right? So one of the issues that we are facing, too, is that financial standards have really tightened. So not only do we have a housing shortage, we have so many fewer homeowners, not through their own choice. And so, you know, just as an anecdote, if you took my same standards when I was buying my first home, I couldn't buy a home today. And when we have raising housing prices, you know, 10 and 20 years later, it makes it even more challenging. So, yeah, so we see a change. We do see a demographic change in more renters. Some are by choice, but I am concerned about people who are renting and who would like to own.
Mm. Another big question that we got, and this goes right into what you were saying, Bernadette, is will it ever get any cheaper? Or at the very least, can we stem the rate of increasing rents and home prices? Bernadette, do you think that's possible?
Yeah, actually, I don't know if Ben has some ideas about that. I know we were chatting about that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is some cause for hope. One thing that I'd point to, for example, where I think we've made really good progress at the state is making it much easier for homeowners to build out what's called accessory dwelling units. So converting a garage, adding a backyard cottage, adding an in-law. Historically, those have been pretty hard to do because they've been either made impossible by local law or the costs that are charged to the homeowners for the permits are too excessive.
I know that was before the legislature. Did that get signed into law?
So we actually have done so there's a bill pending right now that'll take us even one step further. But a series of bills over the last 2 years have really, I think, blown open this area. So we can see a lot more ADUs, as they're called.
And a lot of us call those granny units or
granny
in-law.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's exciting, I think, is when you actually see the analyses that have been done in terms of the potentiality of that, I mean, you can add 40% of additional homes in a single-family community because of the space that exists on those lots already, because you have maybe aging boomers who have some extra space in their home as well. So that's one example where I think we can really take a crack at it.
Matt?
So I think when we talk about, you know, whether there's a solution to this crisis, I think it's important to keep in mind realistic time frames. Mm-hmm. And I think the uncomfortable truth is that even if there is an explosion in ADUs, even if we do ramp up building to a significant degree, it is going to take time for you to actually see prices drop in response to that. Now, that's not pleasant news for anybody who wants to build a home or wants to see their rents decline, but you know, you're not going to see, because of either state action or something in the economy, rents dramatically decrease in the next, you know, 2 or 3 years. That's not what's going to happen. These are long-term solutions.
All right. We heard from Matthew Baird of Los Angeles about whether the property ownership in California is a diversified affair, or is it increasingly becoming concentrated in the hands of a select few. To answer that question is Veronica Beatty, Policy Director for the Sacramento Housing Alliance and a member of the Housing for Sacramento Coalition.
We're definitely seeing a concentration of ownership of property, particularly with the increasing number of Wall Street landlords. So institutions that see housing as investment vehicles. After the foreclosure crisis, we saw corporations like Blackstone Invitation Homes buy up huge swaths of single-family homes that had been foreclosed on and turn them into rentals. And part of that was to create rental-backed securities, so securitizing future rents in the same way that we had mortgage-backed securities causing that crash. And in Sacramento, actually, Blackstone Invitation Homes owns the second most land in the county behind the county itself. So Blackstone Invitation Homes owns more land in Sacramento than the city of Sacramento does. So in addition to concentrating ownership like that, they are exceptionally terrible landlords. Those homes consistently rent for above market. They have maintenance issues. They're not maintained. They can often turn into a source of blight for the neighborhood and a source of stress for residents.
So Bernadette, some strong statements there from Veronica. So we have a supply problem that we already talked about. And then within that supply, we have a concentration of ownership.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Veronica makes some really good points. What I would add to that is that some of the properties that these mega investors own are the perfect types of homes for first-time home buyers. So they're smaller, maybe 1,000 to 2,000 square feet, smaller footprint, so maybe perhaps a smaller yard. And again, the location of these homes are in good proximity to major employment centers or very desirable places to live. And so you have places that would be perfect for people exiting the rental market, entering the ownership market, and yet the properties are not available. And as we've said before, creating new supply takes time.
And then does that push gentrification in some of these neighborhoods that you were talking about? And one that I can think of here just locally is where UC Davis is collaborating with the city of Sacramento to put in what's called Aggie Square. It'll be some 2 million square feet of technology research space. The neighborhoods surrounding that have historically been lower income, and people are worried that that could push that into a rapid gentrification scenario.
Right. I mean, see, one of the issues, the positive issues about home ownership is people can maintain these homes and pass it through generations or get equity to be able to invest it in something else, college educations for their children, a different home, retirement plans. And so when people rent for longer times or never own, they don't have an opportunity to build that equity. They don't have things to share with their children. And so it's something that I'm personally very interested in, is making sure that it's not just a gentrification that's an issue. It really is a displacement. It's one thing to bring in different types of people into your neighborhood, different education or income levels. It's the loss of the people who lived there before and the communities and cultures that they've created that can really be problematic. So we want to be able to support institutions like churches and schools that really rely on some of this longevity within neighborhoods.
Ben, the numbers that Veronica had mentioned were in reference to Sacramento. Do these numbers bear out statewide? Do you see these kinds of things in your dealings?
Yeah. So this is a consequence of the financial crash and recession. We saw a lot of homes that were going vacant. I think the good news is these institutional investors were able to keep the houses occupied. We saw in Florida and other places like houses literally just standing idle and having to be condemned and shut down. But we are getting to a place where I think, credit is getting repaired. We're seeing more folks who are ready to make that jump into home ownership. And I think it'd be good for the state to get its home ownership rate back up a little bit by seeing some of that stock convert back into ownership. We're still today at the lowest home ownership level that we've seen since World War II.
Is that right?
Millennials in particular, communities of color, are really finding it very, very, very hard to get in. And so part of that's availability of stock. Part of that's still difficult getting the right financial products. But part of the wealth building strategy has to be to move the needle a little bit in that direction.
Matt, briefly, your thoughts on ownership concentration?
So one thing that's maybe a little ironic here is investment firms like Blackstone, they were very active in the wake of the Great Recession when home values obviously plummeted here. They're not super active in terms of buying new properties anymore, and that's because housing costs in California are so high. It just doesn't make sense for them in terms of an investment. They are more active in states like Arizona and Florida right now. That's not to say I think the point that they do own some of the housing stock that otherwise would go to new homeowners. I think that's a fair and important point.
All right. Well, we are hearing from CalMatters reporter Matt Levin. That's who was just speaking. Also, Bernadette Austin with the UC Davis Center for Regional Change, and Ben Metcalf, who heads up the California Department of Housing and Community Development. And coming up, we will hear from Gustavo.
We achieved our California dream, not by crying, not by whining, not by saying that people are taking away what's rightfully ours, but by making it happen.
And we've got more answers to your questions about California's housing crisis. Remember, you can find out more about the project on Facebook. We are at facebook.com/groups/CADREAM. Share your thoughts there. We're also on Twitter, so of course there's a hashtag. It is #CADREAM. I'm Randall White at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. You are listening to California Dream, One State, Unaffordable. You are listening to California Dream, One State Unaffordable, and this show was designed to answer your housing questions. In studio to help us with that is Bernadette Austin with the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. Also, Ben Metcalf, who heads the California Department of Housing and Community Development, and CalMatters reporter Matt Levin. Now, one of the questions we heard from a lot from listeners was the impact of immigrants and immigration on California's housing prices. One listener asked us, what is the real cost of immigration to the state? Well, we called up LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano. You may know him from his nationally syndicated Ask a Mexican column. And here's his take on that question.
There is no real cost. It's just Americans. Of course, I'm totally biased on this. My dad came to this country in the trunk of a Chevy. Everyone that I grew up with, if they weren't illegal immigrants themselves, they were either the children of illegal immigrants, they're related to illegal immigrants, or they're just illegal immigrants, you know, or they were in the world of illegal immigration. And all those kids that I grew up with, we all have our white collar jobs. If anything, what's the cost of illegal immigration? It turned a whole bunch of us into people who wanted to make this state a better place and help the poor, as opposed to the middle class who historically wanted to just shut the rest of the world off in their gated communities like Coto de Caza or, whatever. Carmichael. I discovered that one recently. Carmichael. We want to live in the real world. We don't try to insulate ourselves. Anyone who says the quote-unquote cost of illegal immigration is somehow something negative and ruins their dreams, frankly, they're racist and they're dumb.
Gustavo, this project has received some questions from listeners that link immigration and affordability. Is that a valid concern?
Absolutely not. Whether it was Dennis Kearney railing that the Chinese must go to the LA Sheriff's Department putting bum brigades to keep out the Okies coming down the Mother Road, there's always been this insistence that what's keeping quote-unquote Americans from the true California dream are immigrants, even as those immigrants come in, achieve the dream, and then start talking the same trash on the immigrants that follow them.
Gustavo, how do you think California can support immigrants and the working class and still make the state affordable?
The same way we have for 150 years. Make people work. Make people, the problem with affordability and all of this is that there's a lack of work. There's a lack of blue collar jobs now. Everything's turning white collar. And so you're having an economy now where it's a stratified economy in that either there's white collar jobs where you're getting six figure salaries to do computer programming, or now it's a service sector job where you're barely making $30,000 a year, even though you're a barista at Starbucks. You don't have those good middle class jobs. And and the other thing is a lot of the blue collar jobs, it used to be where blue collar jobs also allowed you to have a middle class income. My dad was a truck driver for about 30 years. He started around 87, 88, and he was able to buy a house. He's going to pay off his mortgage this year after 30 years, never missed a payment on time, never, even though, he was out of work for a couple of years. And it's because the trucking industry up until very recently was, very much a blue collar industry, but also something where you could get a good middle class income. You can't do that anymore. Thank God my dad just retired last year.
Okay, so a lot to unpack there. That was LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano. So what about those middle class lives being made on blue collar jobs in years past? Matt Levin?
So I think Gustavo makes a very good point. I think if you look at just the ratio of what housing costs are now to what median income is now in California, that ratio is incredibly out of whack and has been the most out of whack since actually when housing prices peaked right before the financial crisis. But back then, it was super easy to get a loan to afford your home, right, regardless of what your income was. So I think he makes a very good point. It's also, I think, important when we talk about housing. There are a lot of kind of things within housing structurally that keep it expensive, but the labor market and what's going on with the erosion of middle-class jobs, that has a lot to do with affordability as well.
So, Bernadette, how is it that market forces that used to keep those numbers in line don't work today? So you have these salaries that remain low, but these housing prices that continue to skyrocket.
Well, it's interesting. Related to that question is what Gustavo was talking about earlier. federal changes to federal immigration policy and practices is having an impact on the cost of housing. Part of that is because it's really impacting our labor costs. The reduction of immigrants coming to do work in California from outside of the area, whether it's the state or certainly our country, is really driving up costs or having other negative economic impacts on industries like construction, very much so. When you talk to builders, you're definitely hearing that they're having not enough workforce, not different than hospitality or the agriculture industries as well. So that is one issue. But certainly, I mean, I think that really addressed that question pretty well, that the income levels, the average income levels, are not keeping up with what our average housing costs are. And again, I keep going back to home ownership. More importantly, there you can't afford a home. So as your income remains stagnant, you can't afford rising rent costs. But when you own a home, you have a pretty basic baseline level mortgage rate.
Ben, we talk about it a lot. We say that housing prices are skyrocketing and that, you know, salaries are somewhat stagnant. Do the numbers bear out on that? Is that the case statewide?
Well, I think that one of the correlations between the rise in housing prices has been with the increase in jobs, right? So part of the reason that our home prices are going up is because we're seeing great economic productivity. Mm. You know what? California is now the fifth largest GDP in the world, and particularly places like the Bay Area, we're seeing a lot of economic expansion, a lot of job growth. But we're seeing a schism between the number for every, you know, eight jobs that are being created over the last few years, maybe one home is getting put online. And so that's the core pressure there. I think it's a little bit upside down to say, well, immigration is somehow connected with a housing price problem. No, I mean, immigration is a symptom of us having a strong economy, needing workers and people trying to come here. What's interesting is the composition of who's coming and who's leaving. So if you look at inflows and outflows from the state, what you see is the people who are coming into the state tend to be higher income, tend to be white. They tend to be college educated because they're the ones who can afford the homes and are appropriate for the new jobs that are being created. On the other end, we see well north of 100,000 domestic individuals, domestic out-migration individually leaving. They're going to Texas. They're going to Nevada. And those folks are overwhelmingly lower income, communities of color and millennials. So there is a big sort going on in California that's changing what the state is going to look like over time, which is a function of not having enough homes and the nature of the jobs that are coming in.
So I spoke to Gustavo about that very point about people leaving, and he says that that's really not the case, that people are leaving, but the population of California continues to rise and people are coming in to offset that. And he says that, you know, people use that as a point to make California look bad for its policies and that sort of thing. Matt, are people fleeing the state?
Yes. Yes, they are. So I think it's important that we are tempered in how we characterize it. So we've been losing people domestically to other states pretty much for the last two decades consistently. And that is, you know, regardless of how housing prices have fluctuated. But, I mean, Ben is exactly right. California is exporting its poor. That is what's happening here. The people who are leaving the state are making under $50,000 and really making under $30,000. And they're going to places like Texas. They're going to places like Arizona, which may be red states, but they also have lower housing costs. And that is part of the reason why people are going there.
So it's not a drain of the big money in the state. It's a drain of the people that just want to live here but can't afford to anymore.
Yes. And a lot of those people are people of color.
Mm-hmm. I think we should say, like, our economy is not as vibrant as it might be. Could we house those populations? I think that's the other thing we need to say. There's a relationship here. If we had more housing, there would be more opportunities for employers to site jobs. And I think more of the folks that are leaving would stay today.
So because of this supply issue, it seems like building homes would be a cash cow. Like, it would be this great business to get into. But people aren't building homes, Bernadette. Why?
Why aren't they building homes? It's a great question. I mean, so when you look across California, we have coastal and urban areas that it costs more to build there, but it also has pretty high rents and sales prices. But you have to keep in mind that the rural and inland areas, like the Central Valley, the Inland Empire, we have the same cost for supplies and labor. So even though you can't make as much building homes in these areas, there's usually a smaller profit margin. It'll cost a pretty comparable amount to do the rest of the building outside of the land costs. So land cost is really a big issue. So why are the land costs so high? A number of reasons, and I'm sure you can weigh in on this as well. But I think the land costs are high overall around the state, but certainly, again, concentrated in urban and coastal communities because you have a high demand, and the demand is coming from people with very high incomes. And it's not just incomes for people for housing. You're also competing with commercial, industrial, and office space uses for competing land uses.
Some say the problem is rules and regulations. That was a question we heard a lot from our listeners. Capital Public Radio's state government reporter, Ben Bradford, who is also reporting on the California Dream collaboration, has some insight into this one. One of the comments we received and posed to Ben comes from Matthew Stevens, who says, "Why no discussion of zoning? Cause is simple, not enough housing. Solution is simple, build more housing." So that would be the simple solution. Here's Ben to explain why it may be more complicated than that.
This comes down to really the almost philosophical way that our cities approve housing. And I talked to UC Berkeley environmental law professor Eric Bieber for a story that I was doing looking at one state law in particular. But we had this conversation that started talking more generally about how housing gets built and how it gets constrained.
Local governments get a lot of pressure from their constituents to be able to say yes or no to any significant development within the borders of the city. And that's partly because constituents want to have control over how their city develops. It also probably reflects an understandable anxiety on the part of a lot of homeowners in California, for whom their home is one of the most important assets they have, if not the most important asset, that development could pose risks to that home value.
So cities have all these different checks because residents and their constituents want to be able to have a say in developments that are going to go up near them. And what that means is that our approval processes, which have all of these different steps to them, have all of these points where either, you know, the city council or the planning commission can come in and say, we want changes to these projects or we don't want these projects. It's called a discretionary approach to housing. And he's working on a study with other researchers at Berkeley and Columbia University, and it's preliminary. So far, they've looked at 5 Bay Area cities where the housing crisis is at its worst. And what they've done is they've tracked just how long it takes for different cities to go through this process and to get housing approved and, and where things get caught in this process. And what they found is that essentially all the 5 different cities, they have wildly different outcomes. So Oakland and San Francisco have essentially the same process, but it takes housing about twice as long to get approved in San Francisco. His thesis is that the reason that housing is so difficult to build in California is because everybody gets a say in whether or not something gets built.
So if the problem is local governments throwing up roadblocks, then would removing that ability be a viable solution?
Bieber's contention is if you can create more pathways where housing can get built without those kind of checks. And that's what's called kind of an as-of-right or by-right process. So like the big terms to take away from this conversation is discretionary approval and as-of-right approval, which is essentially you check these boxes, a development is going to have X amount of affordable housing, it's going to meet zoning requirements in a certain area, and it gets approved. You know, 2 years ago in the budget, when the legislature first really started concentrating on the issue of housing, they wanted more money for affordable housing. And Governor Jerry Brown, his sort of take on this is that you can't spend your way out of the housing crisis. So ultimately, they had a compromise agreement in the budget. It passed the budget. And it said there will be $400 million for affordable housing if the legislature can agree on some way of creating a by-right housing process, an as-of-right housing process that will streamline development. And they couldn't pass any kind of a bill. And then last January, not this past one, but the year before, I asked Speaker Anthony Rendon about what happened with that. And here's what he said.
I can't be more clear than to say there was no support last year.
And that just shows, I think, also how difficult it is, right? I mean, this is in the Assembly where they are representing the most local people on the statewide level. And so it's they're going to have the most direct response from the smallest neighborhoods of their constituents, who are the same people that, like Bieber was saying, want to have some say in their approval process. And then since then, you know, we saw this year a pretty large attempt to create another kind of by right approval process for affordable housing by Senator Scott Wiener, who you're going to talk to later in the show. And that didn't get out of its first committee. It was very high profile, and its failure was very high profile. Now, lawmakers did pass last year, when they passed this package of affordable housing bills, they did pass one bill, SB 35, that does create this kind of a process for certain projects that have affordable housing. They have to be at least 50% affordable housing. And there's all kinds of other exemptions. And so it'll be a somewhat limited bill, but it does create more of this approval process.
For the California Dream Collaborative, you did a story on one sweeping environmental law that developers have targeted in particular as an impediment to housing. How does that play into this discussion?
Right. So this is the California Environmental Quality Act, this 1970s law that Ronald Reagan signed. It's called CEQA, and developers would say that this is, you know, the biggest problem. Many of them would say that. And so we started looking at this. And essentially, the only reason that CEQA gets implemented in the first place is because there is a discretionary approval process, right? So if you have an as-of-right process, CEQA doesn't kick in the first place. But when it does, it requires very extensive environmental reviews of what a project's effects are going to be. The contention among developers that this is so onerous, this is very difficult to do and takes up a lot of time. What Bieber's research, that same study we were talking about before, has shown is that most housing developments aren't really going through that process. There's all kinds of ways you can kind of bypass or go through streamlined processes, and cities can allow that, and most cities do. But you can also sue. Anybody can sue. I talked to Jennifer Hernandez, who's one of the big CEQA critics. She's an attorney at Holland and Knight. And she talked about how this discretionary process and how CEQA becomes this tool that people use under this process to kill projects.
In CEQA, the odds are almost 50-50 that the government will lose. Because the government could lose the financing of projects that are sued under CEQA, is stopped as soon as there's a lawsuit filed. That's without any showing of, you know, whether the lawsuit has merit. People who say, oh, it's the discretionary approval process, not CEQA. It's CEQA that creates the litigation hook that makes discretionary decisions vulnerable.
In my story, I talked to a lawyer who happens to live on a block in downtown Redwood City, who's challenged two projects, threatened to challenge four projects. He's knocked floors off projects around there, currently blocking an affordable housing development by Habitat for Humanity, all using this law. But there's this question of, you know, how extensive is that really? Hernandez sees CEQA as the hammer that is really the weaponization of this approval process that we have in this kind of philosophical way that we allow housing to be built. And Bieber has looked at the numbers of lawsuits actually filed and says, you know, it's really not that many in these five cities that they've studied that they're looking at so far. It's all preliminary, but it's like 3.5%.
And that's Cap Radio's Ben Bradford. We have to say goodbye to one of our commentators right now, Ben Metcalf, who's been joining us for the hour. He heads the California Department of Housing and Community Development. Ben, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
And this is California Dream, one state unaffordable. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, I'm your host, Randall White. You are listening to California Dream, one state unaffordable. The high cost of housing is pushing many Californians to the edge. Residents are paying rent instead of buying groceries, working 7 days a week to keep their homes. KPBS's Amitha Sharma covers wealth and poverty for the collaboration. We spoke earlier this week and started by asking, what was your takeaway after interviewing retirees who fear the California dream may not be part of their golden years?
That they are absolutely stretched to the limit. I spoke with two women. One of them is a woman by the name of Roseanne Goodwin. She's 63 years old. She gets $2,000 a month in Social Security, but her expenses are $2,400 a month, and her rent has just gone up by 50%. And so up until this rental increase, she has sought to make ends meet by selling her belongings on eBay. And that can only go so far because she only has so many belongings. She's also depended on the goodwill of her friends. She has two friends who send her $200 a month to help her. She also grows food in a garden. But she doesn't know what she's going to do about this latest rental increase. She's asked for some leniency from her landlords. Roseanne also has brain cancer. She was clean for 3 years, but the cancer has come back. She has to have surgery this month. She went to ask her landlord to see if the lease could be extended beyond September and was told that, no, we'd rather have you out sooner rather than later. So she's very much struggling. I also spoke with a woman by the name of Marigold Hernley. She is 70 years old. She still works full time as a realtor. She said that if she didn't, she wouldn't be able to live on her own. And, you know, this is a big issue for seniors, affordable housing. In fact, Marigold said that when senior housing, I think there were about 100 units available down here in San Diego a short time ago, she sought to get into one of those units and then learned that the waiting list was 8,000 people long.
Amitha, after interviewing all these different people that are living right on the edge between housing security and homelessness, what's your takeaway? What do you feel like people don't necessarily understand the issues facing people in this situation?
I actually think people do understand. I think the struggle to make ends meet is far more widespread than we can imagine. It's touching everyone. I have spoken to a lawyer who works full-time, and his wife works full-time. They have $400,000 in student loan debt between the two of them. And he says he tries to sock away $40 a month into a savings account, and he can't. I spoke to another woman who is working on her PhD. She works part-time as a sociology professor at a community college. Her husband works full-time. He's also in school. They have two children. They set out to save $100 each month, but she says that at the end of the month, she always ends up $10 short. And she puts her family finances on an Excel spreadsheet. She's tracking every penny that comes in and every penny that goes out. These are working people. These are educated people. They're not people with gambling addictions. They're not slackers. You know, they're not unemployed. They are people like all of the people we were told as children growing up, that if you work hard, you go to college and you get a job and you continue to work hard and move up, you will be able to settle down, marry, have a child, have children, raise those children, buy a home, have a car, pay for all of your expenses, go on vacation. That's not happening. And everyone can relate to the fact that that is not happening anymore. I mean, what we've seen is wages have stagnated for decades. We've seen that middle-class jobs have left California and very few new middle-class jobs are being created. I think everyone is experiencing that across the board.
Amitha, in the eyes of the people that you've interviewed, what would you say is their perspective when it comes to what the bigger problem is? Is it the ability to own a home in California or rising rents?
It is both. They're between a rock and a hard place here because rents have gone up. I think we spoke to a company called Adam Data. They said rents on a three-bedroom home since 2013 have gone up 19%. Home prices have gone up 40%, yet wages have only gone up 9%. So people, you know, if they can't afford to buy a home and they're renting an apartment, they're also being priced out of that market as well.
Amita Sharma at KPBS in San Diego, thank you so much for sharing what you've learned during your California Dream reporting assignments.
Thank you, Randall.
And Amita there mentioning several situations where people are working. They, you know, they have jobs. They're even counting their pennies, but they still just can't get by living here in California. We're talking with Bernadette Austin with the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. Also, Cal Matters reporter Matt Levin. And Bernadette, did anything stand out for you there in Amita's responses to her reporting?
Absolutely. You know, I'm sure that Ben would talk about this if he were here, but we have some really great programs for permanent supportive housing for people who have mental illness, are living with mental illness, or are veterans. So we have some really great supportive programs. But what we're really struggling with is addressing people who are on the verge of homelessness. My brother is an attorney, and he's been a social worker working with homeless individuals. And it's really dramatic to see what that caseload looks like. He's talked about people who've been real estate agents and teachers who are now living in their cars. And so people just being right on the verge of homelessness. This is not, again, what Amita was saying. People who have other personal or maybe psychological issues that are struggling with homelessness, these are really working people, middle-class people, who are approaching homelessness or are really struggling with housing stability.
The one story that Amita did that really, I always know it's a great reporting job when I lose myself listening to it, when I'm anchoring the news here at night and I start listening to the piece and I forget where I am. I forget that I actually have to start talking when she's done doing her story. And one piece that she did on the guy who sleeps in his car by night and then uses it as a Lyft Uber car during the day was just really grabbed me. It was really stunning to me. Matt, what was your takeaway from some of Mamitha's points?
I think she's describing a increasingly common experience here in California. I think, like she said, a lot of people don't like to admit it, but they are living paycheck to paycheck because their rent is so expensive. And I think it also speaks to how people are now kind of viewing homelessness here in California in kind of a different way, whereas obviously there are substance abuse and mental illness issues there, but the face of homelessness has been changing recently because rent prices have been increasing so dramatically. It is people who simply can't afford a place to live.
We've heard from a lot of listeners since we put the word out that we'd like to hear their housing concerns for this program, and we thought, let's get a politician to answer some of these questions. We reached out to State Senator Scott Wiener, Democrat from San Francisco. He's at the center of much of the housing debate in Sacramento. And we asked him to help answer this and some other questions.
Hi, my name's Heidi Hansen. I live in the rural section of Lincoln, between Lincoln and Auburn. How do one-size-fits-all laws at the state level negatively impact cost-of-living issues for urban versus rural areas?
You know, sometimes we hear this argument, oh, this is because the state is doing it, it's a one-size-fits-all approach. Well, anytime the state of California passes a law, it can be described as a one-size-fits-all approach. The reality is that housing is a statewide problem in California. It is not a city-by-city issue. No city by itself can solve the housing crisis. When every city acts together, we can. But what we have found over the years is that when you have pure local control for housing, which is what we have, almost pure local control until very recently, it doesn't work. It becomes a race to the bottom. Every city, every neighborhood has a strong incentive to limit the amount of housing, to vote down projects, to fight projects, to make it really hard and lengthy and expensive to get anything approved and built, and to say, hey, I know we need housing, but my community is not the appropriate place to put that housing. And so at some point, we have to recognize that doing it city by city, where every neighborhood gets to decide for itself whether any development happens in that neighborhood, it doesn't work anymore. And we need to have statewide standards, still local control. And I'm a former local elected official. I believe in local control. But that local control needs to operate within state standards. The same thing that we do for public education. We would never say that local school districts can do anything they want. Any number of days per year of education, you know, whether or not they want to have credentialed teachers or teach science and math, we set state standards and the local control exists within those standards. And that's what we need to do with housing. So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It's about saying this is a statewide problem with a statewide deficit of 3.5 million homes, and we need to address it at a state level.
Senator Wiener, we have another question from one of our listeners in San Diego.
My name is Marigold, and I'd like to know, where are you going to put everybody? What projects are you putting together to house older people that have a little bit of income, that are one step away from the street? What are you going to do to help people like that?
Well, we are spiking homelessness overall by not having enough housing and by not investing enough in low-income housing as a safety net. There's a perception out there by some that everyone who's homeless must be severely mentally ill or drug addicted. And that's not true. It's true for some, but there are plenty of homeless people, whether they're seniors, whether they're working families, whether they're children attending public school, who have been pushed out of housing because there is nothing for them. And we have decided as a state that our de facto policy will be, we don't need enough housing for everyone. And people at the lower end of the economic ladder are always going to suffer the worst. So in terms of vulnerable seniors in particular, and we have a huge population of vulnerable seniors in California, we need to make sure that we are aggressively investing in low-income housing specifically for seniors. We also have to make sure that low-income seniors who are renters are able to remain stable in their housing. There's battles going on around the state around rent control. Rent control, particularly for seniors, can be very, very helpful in keeping people stable in their housing. So there are a number of things we need to do, but the last thing we need is to have more and more homeless or marginally housed seniors. These are people who have spent their lifetime in our state and our communities, and they deserve the absolute basic dignity of being able to remain in housing, or if they need new housing, to be able to actually find that housing.
On the topic of rent control, we've spoken a lot today about the proposition that would get rid of Costa Hawkins. Where do you fall on that?
I support reforming Costa Hawkins. Right now, the law is too rigid in basically saying that anything that was built in the last several decades, in San Francisco, it's 40 years. In many places, it's about 20, 25 years, that none of this new construction can ever become rent controlled. That's too rigid. We need to allow local flexibility to allow new housing over time to transition into rent control. It had been my hope that there would be a negotiation in the legislature to resolve this and to have a reform. Instead, everyone went into their corner, and we have advocates advocating for a total repeal and then a huge amount of money that's going to be spent against that. And it's my hope that we'll be able to have a compromise. If not, the voters will speak.
Senator Wiener, I know you're concerned with people getting pushed farther and farther away from their jobs. We heard from Lauren Jody on Facebook, who's concerned about the people who serve coffee or clean bathrooms for $20,000 a year in these very expensive cities. Where will they live? How are they factored into solutions?
It's a major problem. We have made it increasingly hard for particularly our service sector employees to be able to afford to live anywhere near where they work. And what that leads to is people having big, big commutes, or it becoming increasingly hard for businesses to hire employees because people can't afford to live near where they work and they don't want to commute long hours, so they'd rather work somewhere else. And so investing in low-income and low-income housing, keep in mind, is not only housing for the poorest of the poor. Low-income housing is very helpful also for, you know, the baristas of the world and people who are making a living but are not making a ton of money. But over time, as we build more housing overall, housing will be more affordable to the middle class. And again, that's a long-term project, and that is little consolation to someone who is struggling with housing today. We just got to get started now. We should have started 20 years ago and get it done. And in the meantime, make sure that when people do have housing, particularly renters who are not wealthy, that we are helping people stay in their housing.
So about midway through that conversation there, Senator Wiener brought up the ballot initiative that would repeal Costa-Hawkins, opening the door for cities to initiate some form of rent control. Matt Levin, I know you've been waiting to answer this question. It's sort of rent control. This whole thing is sort of the third rail of politics, huh?
Yeah, at least in housing, for sure. I think that along with Prop 13, those are two things that people do not like to talk about very much. It's going to be a war this November. And I think there's a lot of wind behind the backs of tenants advocates who are pushing this initiative. You know, here in Sacramento, Sacramento has topped the list nationally of cities with year-over-year rent increases. There are a lot of forces that I think bode well for the proponents of this initiative. We'll see how it actually plays out in November. The Apartment Association, which is the landlord organization, they're going to spend a ton of money trying to kill this thing because it really strikes at the core of what they do.
So we'll be seeing a few ads.
Yes.
Bernadette, the senator, also mentioned the difference between local control and statewide control with the one-size-fits-all sort of question. How does that work when it comes to housing?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think that, again, taking a regional approach is a really important approach. So we have a regional housing needs assessment that really translates what amount of housing is needed from the state to the local government. But I want to make sure that listeners really understand that policymakers and planners are really doing the best they can. But residents and the general public need to understand that we all need to work together to address this housing situation. As a planning commissioner, I entertained a development which was an infill development, dense, moderate size and income, and had some lower parking ratios. And many residents were very upset. This is not new to my community. And I had to say, this is not a unique situation to my city. It's a unique situation to our entire state. And we're all going to have to really work together to address our housing crisis.
Bernadette Austin with the UC Davis Center for Regional Change. Also, CalMatters reporter Matt Levin, thanks to you both. And you've been listening to California Dream, One State, Unaffordable. The California Dream Project is a statewide media collaboration of CalMatters, KPBS, KPCC, KQED, and Capital Public Radio. The project gets support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the James Irvine Foundation. Keep the discussion going on our Facebook group. It's facebook.com/groups/CADream. We're also on Twitter with the hashtag CADream. California Dream, One State, Unaffordable, produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. The California Dream editor, Adrian Hill. Our digital team, Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Technical director, Mark Jones. Executive producer, Joe Barr. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be right back.